A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on March 20, 1994, in the series The Seven Last Words from the Cross, entitled I Thirst. The scripture reading is John 19, verses 28 through 30. The text for the sermon is John 19, verse 28. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
I thirst. The fifth word from the cross, the second word that John records, a word obviously of physical suffering. We are told that there is no physical suffering any greater than the suffering that comes from one who is thirsty. But we have learned in our study of John's Gospel that John uses words and ideas at more than one level. To be sure, it's a word of physical suffering. There was genuine thirst, no doubt. But in this account of cosmic consequence would John put on Jesus' lips, I thirst. Might there be something else going on with this word? The special angle that we are using to approach these words this Lenten season is to see them not so much as words Jesus spoke, but of words that the evangelist put on the lips of Jesus in order to explain, to interpret the meaning of the death of Jesus and what was happening in that death. For the gospel writers were not court reporters recording every word, nor were they journalists working for the Jerusalem Times looking for a front page byline. The gospel writers were theologians in their own right. They were storytellers. Maybe we could call them theological novelists. They were portrait painters, not photographers. They were interested in interpreting the meaning of the events that they were recording. And I hope you've caught the different nuances in the respective Gospels during this season. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we call them the Synoptic Gospels because those three have an essential core in common. But John stands apart. And it's interesting to note the contrasts between the portrait John paints of Jesus on the cross and the portrait we get from the others. Now, don't hear me to say that one is right and one is wrong. Hear me to say that we have different points of view, perspectives, understandings, seeking to communicate different things. Last week, the fourth word, the word of abandonment, my God, why? Mark, the earliest written gospel, followed closely by Matthew, have only that word. Jesus dies hanging in darkness, derelict, despair. Not so John's Christ. John's Jesus is always in control. From the very beginning, Jesus calls the shots. His mother said to him at the wedding in Cana, boy, make some wine. He said, what have I to do with you, woman? My hour has not yet come. Philip and Andrew came to him. 12th chapter. He said, Jesus, there are some Greeks here at the feast. They want to see you. We never know if they saw him or not. He goes into this monologue. Now is the hour. And he struggles. Unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it abides alone. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? No, but for this hour came I forth. Father, glorify your name. Gethsemane is in John's gospel, but not the threefold prayer of Jesus, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Rather, at the arrest, Peter draws his sword and Jesus reprimands him and he says, the cup the Father has given me, shall I not drink it? Jesus is in control. 10th chapter, the Good Shepherd passage. Shepherd loves his sheep. I am the Good Shepherd. I lay down my life for the sheep. No one takes it from me. John's Jesus is one who calls the shots. And now, our text is introduced with the phrase, Jesus coming to realize that all is finished or completed. Jesus says, I thirst. Finished, completed, I thirst, and then his final word in John, it is finished. The idea of completion is here. And when Jesus realizes that it's complete, he says, I'm thirsty. Has he now brought the work to completion where he can sit back for a moment and sip a wine? What is he saying? What is John trying to convey to us when he puts those words on Jesus' lips? Well, Jesus in John is the Passover lamb. Jesus in John, in contrast to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, does not observe the Passover on the night in which he was betrayed. There is a Last Supper. But the chronology in John's gospel is different. Jesus is crucified at the hour that the Passover lambs are being slain. Now, when Jesus says, I thirst, what do? They take some hyssop and they give him some vinegar or some wine. He drinks it. Do you suppose that John would be saying to us, suggesting to us, that Jesus, having brought things now to their finished point, recognizing that it was now all over, said, give me the cup. The words, I thirst, might be John's rather subtle way of saying that the Jesus who had said, the cup that the Father gives me, shall I not drink it, is now saying, it is complete, it is over, now give me the cup and I will drain it to its very last dregs. The cup. What is the cup? Well, the cup of suffering, yes. The cup in terms of God's will for Jesus' life, what Jesus was called to, yes. But there's a cup also, a cup on the communion table. Where does that cup come from? Where does that chalice come from? Well, it comes from the Passover feast, doesn't it? And in John's gospel, Jesus is the Passover lamb. Jesus dies when the Passover lambs are being killed. Jesus doesn't observe the Passover. Jesus is the Passover. Do you remember the story of Passover? Where does it come from? Let me remind you. It's the book of Exodus. It's the story of the deliverance of Israel out of Egypt. Remember the oppression of Pharaoh? The Israelites crying to heaven because of their terrible oppression, their abuse. And God calling Moses and saying, go and set my people free. And Moses goes to Pharaoh and he says, set these people free. And Pharaoh says, no way, Jose. And God says, well, let's get a little action going then. And we have the 10 plagues. Do you remember the 10th plague? The 10th plague was that the firstborn in every household would die. Well, if the Israelites are there in Egypt, how will the Israelites avoid their firstborn dying? Because, you see, the angel of death will pass over the land. That's where we get Passover. The angel of death would pass over. Well, Moses gave them instructions. You are to be ready to go, all packed up, and then have a final meal, a kind of celebratory meal, in which you will roast a lamb whole. No bone shall be broken. And you shall take the blood of the lamb, and you shall take a hyssop plant, shrub, hyssop. Got it? Dip it in that blood and sprinkle it on the doorposts, so when the angel of death cruises over, the angel of death will know where to spare the firstborn. That is a house of the Israelites. There is the doorpost sprinkled with blood. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. And Moses said to Israel, celebrate this every year to be reminded that God has set you free. Celebrate this every year to remember that your God is a God of freedom and of liberation. The Passover lamb in the Exodus event, which is the originating image for John's understanding of Jesus, was not a sin offering. The lamb in John's understanding, going back to the Exodus, was the lamb of liberation. The Israelites sprinkled the blood of the lamb, which represented the life of the lamb, on the doorpost, saying to God, we offer ourselves to you. You spare our firstborn, but in the blood of the lamb, in the life of the lamb, we acknowledge your total claim on our lives. We are your people, O God. Now, John sees Jesus as a Passover lamb. As I said, when the lambs are being slaughtered in the temple down in Jerusalem, Jesus is being crucified on Golgotha. John's chronology makes it such that Jesus himself is the Lamb of God. And what John is saying, I believe, in these words, I thirst, is give me the cup. Let me drink the cup. Let me complete it now because all things are ready. It is finished. It is over. To give me the cup, I'll drain it to the last dregs. And in so doing, Jesus was completing his work and breathing his last. And he could proclaim, it is over. Because what John was understanding that Jesus was doing on the cross was that Jesus was liberating the world like Moses liberated the Israelites. As the Israelites were living in a terrible situation of human bondage and coercion and abuse, so the whole world lies in oppressive structures, dehumanization, where human life is not valued and where human rights are denied. And what John was saying of Jesus is that in dying, Jesus is the Passover lamb who sets the people free. As Israel was delivered from the bondage of Egypt, so the world will be delivered from all oppressive structures, and Jesus is the liberator over against all forms of human bondage. That is an understanding of the death of Jesus that jives with the life of Jesus. Jesus' whole life was a life that upset everybody and every institution and shattered every structure, because life gets structured in order to control people. The managers of society, the power brokers of society, have institutional forms and structures whereby people are under control and managed. And Jesus hit at the very heart of that control system when he hit at the church-state alliance. You see, well, let me make three comments. If you will grant my suggestion that Jesus, through John's window, is the Passover lamb who sets the world free for God and for human dignity, then let me just make these three comments. The first is that the physical suffering was real, and in no way would I diminish it nor devalue it. There was a serious challenge to the early church's understanding of Jesus and the gospel. It came from what we call Gnosticism. Gnosticism did not believe that God really identified with Jesus. Gnosticism would deny that the Word could become flesh, because the flesh was evil, matter was evil, material world was evil. The Gnostics would say that Jesus would take a walk down the beach but leave no footprints. And the Gnostics claimed that when Jesus was on the cross, the Spirit had left, that God in Jesus did not really suffer, because God is Spirit and Spirit cannot be crucified. Well, I say that because we still in the church tend to focus on the physical suffering, and I think often lose the big picture. Roman Catholic piety, particularly out of Spain and into Latin America, this time of the year parades the crucifix through town, and there's actually flagellation and the drawing of blood in order that the pious ones may identify with Jesus in his physical suffering. Now, he did suffer physically. I do not demean it, but I would say that for us to try to identify with that physical suffering is to really miss the word of the cross to us. The Roman Catholics do it with the crucifix and flagellation in some parts. We Protestants do it with the miserable Lenten hymns. Now, I've just talked about some of the hymns you love, but you love them because the tune goes nicely and you know the words and you can sing them without even thinking. And that's part of the joy of life, having things that you can, like a pair of old shoes, some of these hymns. But I'll tell you what, if you take the hymn book and you read some of the hymns, some of the stuff, you don't really mean it. They're full of human vileness, you know, for such a worm as I'm not a worm, frankly, and neither are you. And this terrible suffering of Jesus that brings a tear to our eyes, well, let's get honest. When is the last time you sat there with tears in your eyes identifying with the physical suffering of Jesus? I think it has become one of those kind of thoughtless parts of our tradition. And those old hymns, I'm not sure those old hymns are a genuine expression of our understanding and valuing of the crucifixion. No, the physical was real. We may not deny it. We must not deny it. But the real suffering of Jesus was a this-worldly suffering. It was a worldly suffering. Now, we've made the death of Jesus and the cross of Jesus, we've made it into a religious thing. My goodness, it's the very central symbol of the church. We have domesticated the death of Jesus. We've brought it into the church. We have spiritualized it. We have individualized it. It has become a kind of sweet Jesus and me, a kind of me and Jesus. It has been that awful suffering of Jesus which opens the gates of heaven and lets me go in. And we have really missed. We've really missed the larger context of the death of Jesus. It was not simply something religious. It was a political act. Jesus was killed by Rome, suffered under Pontius Pilate, the Apostles' Creed says. Well, you say, yeah, but the high priestly crowd started it. Well, yes, but why did they start it? They started it not so much because Jesus had some erroneous theology. They started it because Jesus was undercutting the manageable structures of society. They were afraid. I mean, the high priestly family didn't have it too bad when Rome was the occupier. They had reached an accommodation. They had their position. They had their prestige, their pomp. They carried on with the temple. There was an accommodation between the church and the state. And Jesus undercut it all. When the high priest went to Pilate, it was a political act. It was not a religious act. And Jesus died a political criminal. Jesus' suffering was a worldly suffering. It was a this worldly suffering. Jesus had, in his whole ministry, sought to set people free. He was the Moses of the New Testament. He delivered the world from every form of human bondage. He put his life on the line in order that none might be excluded and all might be touched and embraced. He brought God to the people. It was a this-worldly suffering that Jesus self-consciously took on and followed through to the end. And he said, I'm thirsty. And I don't think John was simply reporting the fact that Jesus was thirsty, although Jesus certainly must have been thirsty. John has the dying Jesus say, I thirst, which was John's way of having Jesus say, give me the cup. Let me drain the cup to the end, because all is now finished. The physical suffering was real, but that wasn't the real point. The real picture through the window of John is this Passover lamb dying for the liberation of the world, the setting of people free, a this-worldly suffering. And my third comment is that it was freely chosen by Jesus, not something, according to John, that was pressed upon him. And probably the best example I can hold before you, and I do it at least once a year at this time of the year, in our own history, or at least some of us who are a little older, was a decision of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, brilliant theologian, Christian pastor, who in the 40s, 39, went back to Germany, allied himself with the forces of right and good and justice, eventually got hooked up in a conspiracy to assassinate Hitler in order to bring his own nation down, in order, he was convinced, to save Western civilization. I have my little book here. It takes a rubber band. It takes clips. But to me, this is sacred because in my European pilgrimage, it kept me alive. I was reading his letters and papers again yesterday. To be a Christian does not mean to be religious in a particular way, to cultivate some particular form of asceticism, but to be a man, a human being. It is not some religious act which makes a Christian what he is, but participation in the suffering of God in the life of the world. Bonhoeffer talked with a French pastor who had a desire to be a saint, and Bonhoeffer said, I didn't really agree with him, but I was impressed by him. But he said, the more I'm here now, and he's in prison now, and his life is at stake now, and all of Europe is eroding around him, and Western civilization falling apart, and there's a demonism, hell has broken loose on this world. And Bonhoeffer says, it is only by living completely in this world that one learns to believe. One must abandon every attempt to make something of oneself. This is what I mean by worldliness, taking life in one's stride with all its duties and problems, its successes and failures, its experiences and helplessness. It is in such a life that we throw ourselves utterly into the arms of God and participate in his suffering in the world and watch with Christ in Gethsemane. And he might have said, thirst with Christ on the cross. Would Jesus have joined the conspiracy? Boy, that's a good question. It wouldn't seem so, but Bonhoeffer wrestled with it, and as a Christian, as a disciple of Jesus, trying to live a this-worldly devotion, he decided to become a part of the conspiracy. No one can tell you whether you should or you shouldn't, but all must agree that what Jesus was about was this kind of worldly involvement, this kind of worldly engagement. It was not something that happened in the temple. It was not something restricted to the altar. Piety and devotion is not a little compartment of our lives while the rest of our lives we go on and go by all the standards and values of the world. No, to follow Jesus, to go the way of Jesus, is to be engaged in the world in a very real, concrete sense. In the politics of the world, for Jesus' sake, in the name of God, for the liberation of people, for the humanization of society, for peace in the world. That's all of that is in that word, I thirst. It's not easy. I suppose that Jesus said, why me, when his home synagogue rejected him? I suppose he said, why me, when his mothers and brothers didn't believe in him? I suppose his heart was broken when he went to Jerusalem, to the temple, to the very heart of his covenant faith, and found himself rejected. Bonhoeffer mentions Martin Luther. Martin Luther took his stand. Here I stand, I can do no other. But he could have done other. He could have just wrapped it up. He could have just walked away. He could have just said, well, have it your way. He could have just gone off to a monastery and studied the Psalms in Hebrew. I don't know what makes someone like Bonhoeffer follow Jesus to his death, or Martin Luther, or Martin Luther King. It's not easy. Bonhoeffer's most moving lines to me, maybe the most moving lines in my life, "Who am I?" in which he describes how people see him in prison, bright, shining, full of joy, full of hope. Now he sees himself, how he knows himself. Restless, longing, sick, fear and trembling. Who am I, this or the other? Am I one person today and tomorrow another? Am I both at once a hypocrite before others and before myself, a contemptibly woebegone weakling? Who am I? They mock me, these lonely questions of mine. Whoever I am, thou knowest, O God, I am thine. Following in the way of Jesus. I know for some, devotion before a crucifix is a means of grace. I know for some, words of an old Lenten hymn speak to the depth. But I know that for John, Jesus was about something bigger, about the world, about setting people free, about humanization, about liberation. And there is a way to identify with Jesus. It's not really a mystery. And it's not even mystical. It's simply to hear His word. If you would be my disciple, take up your cross and follow me. I must label that word with a warning. Fulfilled faithfully, it is fraught with pain, and it may cost your life. But you have your soul.